Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twitta. Joe Kurtek embodies a modern-day Alaskan. Joe worked for 40 years mapping Alaska's geology. Along the way, he also pursued his love of skiing and sea kayaking. On this Outdoor Explorer, Joe shares his wealth of knowledge of Alaska's geology and some of his many adventures. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. Joe, welcome to the show.
Boy, it's great to be here. Thanks for the invite, and like I say, it's a real pleasure to be here, Paul.
Boy, we have so much to talk about. I've known you for probably 30 or 40 years since I've been in Alaska, and your life is, you've done so much as a field geologist with the BLM, kayaking, skiing, so much. But let's start with your youth. Like, I always like to ask people, like, how'd you get in the outdoors? How'd you end up been interested in geology in Alaska?
All right. Well, to tell you about how I got into geology, I guess let's go back to the beginning of my life. And I was born in Moscow, Idaho, but our family moved to a little town in Eastern California, a little town called Bishop on the eastern side of the Sierra. And my dad was a chemist, and so I became very familiar with the periodic table at an early age. And my dad got a job at the Pine Creek Tungsten Mine just outside of Bishop, which is located just on the eastern foot of the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And so I became, introduced to mining at a very early age. And I was very, very, well, let me back up just a minute. Tungsten, they mine tungsten at this mine, and tungsten is an element that's very important for many different things. Everything from hardened steel for drill bits, light bulbs, filaments, studded tire studs, any place that you need a very hard, resistant metal that also keeps its integrity at high temperatures. And this Pine Creek Tungsten Mine was located way up in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Some of the workings are up to 13,000 feet. And that one mine was responsible in its 50-year time that it was open for probably about a third of the tungsten produced in this country. So very, very significant operation. So we lived in a company town, one of the last few company towns you've probably ever seen, all the houses all in a row with numbers. And that's where I had my early years. I guess that was about three. I was probably about 3 years old when we moved there. And I was very fortunate as a young person to have parents that were very interested in the outdoors and doing things outdoors. And I was very lucky in that way. They introduced me to the outdoors, wild country, and basically, just a great area to be in. That's some of the highest part of the Sierra Nevada, the peaks behind where we grew up, basically was our back door. And as a kid, we lived a ways outside of town, pretty isolated. We didn't have TV. We were lucky if maybe one of the parents would take us to the Saturday Night Picture Show. So there wasn't a whole lot of those other entertainments. So my brother Dan and I, we entertained ourselves by exploring that backcountry, that mountain range right behind our house. And we were like, a couple of coyotes roaming the landscape. And my mother would say, well, be back in time for dinner. And so we just explored and explored. And I was very lucky, too, that my parents took me out into this country. And my dad was big into hunting and fishing. So initially it was going up to all these high lakes and fishing, hunting. My dad always liked to bring something back. Okay. So as time went on, I kept looking at up all these high peaks from these lakes and going, wow, it'd be really neat to get up and climb some of those and see what's going on. So my dad was like, well, you know, you're going to get killed going up there and doing that sort of thing. So he held us back for a while. But after a point, he couldn't hold my brother and I back. So we started climbing and exploring those mountains. And in the process of doing that, I mean, there's just incredible geology in that part of California. I'm looking around and going, boy, how did these mountains get here? How did Mother Nature put all this together, this landscape that we see today? So as a young man, decided to go over the hill and down the creek and see how Mother Nature put the world together, basically, at a very early age. And I was very lucky to have mentors early on in my life. And I remember when I got to high school, it was the first geology class that was ever put on at our high school there in Bishop. And the instructor was Charlie Specht, and he was definitely a mentor of mine. He would take us on field trips and out and see all the different rock types and that. And it was definitely influential. In fact, three of us, along with me, Mark Johnson, and Bill Durbin, three of us actually became geologists, and I think probably that was a result of the influence of that class. We ended up, becoming geologists and spending careers, doing geologic work. And also, I was very lucky too. Besides geology, I had a track and cross country running coach there, Dave Sharp. And he was into cross-country skiing. And this is in the 60s, when not a whole lot of people were into, knew about cross-country skiing. It was all alpine. So he introduced me into going in the backcountry in wintertime and skiing. And that's something that, I've kept up for the rest of my life, that sport. And also just staying in good shape physically and all that. And I've carried with me, that through all my years, since that time. Still very active skiing and have gotten involved with ski patrol, which I'll talk about a little bit later.
That's interesting. So not just any skiing, but backcountry skiing.
Yes.
What kind of equipment were you on
back then? Oh, boy. Back then, the equipment was you found some skis at Sears and Roebuck, and there was one place, the Ski Hut in Berkeley, California, where you could actually get some bindings. We called them the bear trap bindings.
Oh, yeah.
And you basically put your hiking boots in them. They had kind of a spring cable behind them, and it was very primitive. And that's kind of what we used for bindings. That sort of equipment was just not available much back then. But
you didn't have the 110 centimeter underfoot,
no.
Big fatty. Yeah.
No, did not have big fatties and all that stuff. I think it was all wood in those days. But that introduced me to other skiing other than alpine, that there's some great adventures, with backcountry skiing, too. There. So it was a great upbringing, introduction to geology and climbing those peaks. I ended up with a love for views from high places, and which has also followed me for the rest of my life, because I'm still into mountaineering and scrambling and, climbing peaks. I just love doing that sort of thing. So,
yeah. Were you technically climbing? Were you just learning as you went?
Kind of learn as we went. We'd end up getting some ropes and carabiners and stuff like that, and tried to do some rope climbing. Kind of went to a few classes. See, that Bishop side, I called what the Yosemite dropouts ended up there. The Yosemite dropouts. We had people like Doug Robinson, various others. Yvon Chouinard used to show up over there. And so there was a lot of interest in climbing there, because you had this great mountain venue, right next to Bishop there, which was just fantastic. So there was the whole climbing culture was there. And now it's become very popular with the rock climbers. Oh, yeah, Bishop's like on the map for rock climbing, sort of thing. Oh, yeah. In fact, what's his name? Honnehold trained in Bishop before he did his big spread misère of climbing Half Dome and El Cap and all that kind of stuff.
Right, the movie Solo.
He trained. He trained in Bishop. It's very, and it was easy to get into. That environment was there.
Do you think climbing influence? I know climbers get into geology. A lot of climbers, they start off as climbers and they eventually become geologists. Was there a relationship there where you're like on the rocks going, oh, I want to know more about this rock?
Oh, yeah. That was definitely influential. Just looking over this landscape from these peak tops. How did this come to be, And, that's definitely was influential. And then also being around the mine, being around the tungsten mine, being around the engineers and the geologists and all that. In fact, I actually worked in that mine summers when I was going to college and was a geologist assistant and all that, and just learned kind of all about the mining business and how geology related to extracting a metal out of the rock at a profit, basically.
Uh-huh.
So that was the other influence. And there was one of the mining engineers, Don Markle, who had gone to school at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the 1930s.
Huh.
And he would always tell me stories about working on the riverboats, the gold dredges, and all that sort of thing. And there was definitely some influence there to get me interested in Alaska. I mean, I grew up in Bishop, it was like, well, where do I go where the mountains are higher and the glaciers are bigger, was Alaska. But I'll get into that. I'll get into that as we go along, how I ended up here and all that. So
did you... And did you develop lifetime friends? Do you have the people that you still climb with or stay in touch from the climbing?
Yes, I do. I have, in fact, my one buddy who also became a geologist, Mark Johnson. He was in that same geology class. He and I just celebrated our 50th year of doing trips together.
Oh, nice.
And we're going to get together, and we're going to do a trip in Sierra, in the Sierra here in August. So
that's wonderful.
It's a long, long friendship that I've kept up. And then also my brother. My brother and I were both into the climbing thing, and there's another good partner. So, yeah, I've kept up lots of relationships, you know, over the years, which is so valuable.
The outdoors seems to do that, too.
Yeah.
Or not, sometimes.
Right.
And then... Then what? You were in high school, inspired in the geology.
Yep.
What was next?
Well, I got inspired in geology. Of course, I get out of high school, and it's like, okay, now what do I do with myself? You know, it's kind of like the world, I guess, is at your feet or your oyster at that point. I knew I wanted to work outside, and I also wanted to get into something where I could use my brain a little bit to figure things out, you know, what's going on. And I looked at various things, geography, this and that, and I'm going, you know, where can I actually do something that might put beans on the table, you know? And so that's when, I think geology would probably be a pretty good thing for you, because you can take your vocation, your interest in climbing and everything, and turn it into a career. So I ended up enrolling in college up at the University of Nevada, Reno there at the Mackey School of Mines, and enrolled there. And again, I started taking geology classes, and it was all very interesting. And then maybe you've had this happen in your life, Paul, where you have these, how would I say, these fortuitous moments, turning points.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in mineralogy class one day. Professor comes up to me, who had worked in Alaska, and said, "Hey, Joe, there's a buddy of mine down the hall here that's interviewing guys to work in Alaska in geology for the summer. You might want to go talk to him." Well, that was the moment that changed my whole life.
Yeah.
It was pretty interesting. Anyway, I ended up getting a job for the summer, flew to Alaska, worked out in the Wrangell St. Elias Mountains. This is pre-park. I mean, this is like 1971 at this point. Spent a summer working there, and I was hooked on Alaska. Holy mackerel. You know, I'd read all the Jack London books, and like I say, the engineer that worked at the mine who influenced me so much, I didn't even want to go back to college after that summer. I was just going to go out, in the woods and build my cabin, and that was going to be it. But luckily, more level heads prevailed, and I went back and ended up finishing a degree in geology. And then I did stay on and got a master's degree in geology.
So. Let's come back to that to a second. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and we're with Alaska Public Media. I am talking to Joe Kurtak about his life as an Alaskan geologist. So we're in college, and you had a master's, and you kept coming back up to Alaska?
Yeah, I worked in Alaska from about 75 to 77 for various mineral exploration companies. Then they sent me down to Colorado, worked down there for a while. But Alaska was always in the back of my mind, the place I wanted to get back to. And one thing about working in the geology field, especially if you're tied into economic geology, is has its real ups and downs. Okay, and you know, the one metal might be the big thing at a time, and all kinds of geologists get hired. You go out and you work, and you find a whole bunch of that metal, and then, okay, we found it all. Let's lay everybody off. So it's very cyclic. It's very cyclic. And I was working down in Colorado, and I was working in uranium at that time, and then Three Mile Island happened, and people did not really want to get into uranium anymore. So I basically could see the end coming down there, that I was going to get laid off because uranium business was just crashing. Well, another very fortuitous moment in my life. I could see the end coming, and I saw there was an advertisement in a magazine that the U.S. Bureau of Mines, part of the Interior Department, was looking for geologists for Alaska. So I still remember sitting in my motel room one night kind of frustrated and filled this. That was the old long government form to fill out.
Yeah.
You know, I had to fill this thing out all in hand, threw it in an envelope, threw it in a mailbox, and went on and did my thing. Well, it wasn't until a few weeks later I got my layoff notice. Oh, whoa. Okay, now what do I do?
Now
well,
it's real.
That's right. Now it's real. And it couldn't have been more than a week later I get this call from Alaska, from this geologist in Alaska, saying, "Hey, do you still interested in that government job up here?" Well, as you can tell, that probably didn't take me long to answer that question. And so I came back to Alaska that was 1980, and I've pretty much been here ever since, you know, doing geology, and I made a career out of, you know, being here in Alaska.
And that was that job with the BLM? then?
That was with the Bureau of Mines, U.S. Bureau of Mines. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And my first, moving up here in 1980, my first project was working out in Prince William Sound.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
at the time, the Forest Service had this, what was called the RARE 2 project, and it was the Roadless Area Resource Evaluation. Yeah. And it was basically to do mineral assessments on all lands in the National Forest, basically to get a catalog of all the mineral resources out there. So as they're doing their planning, are they going to create wildernesses? Are they going to do this? Whatever, they know where the different mineral occurrences are that, you know, may get developed at some point. So my job was to go out and evaluate all those mineral occurrences. And we would see the Chugach National Forest, I believe, is the second largest national forest in the country. It's about 6 million acres. It was a huge, huge area. So we divided it up into three different areas. And I was lucky enough to get the central part, what we call the islands area, which was Latouche Island, Elmer Island, that whole kind of that central part. And boy, that was the project I was given. And talk about being thrown into the breach. Luckily, I had a really good boss, Don Blasco, at the time, who really, how would I say, mentored me to work out in that country. Because here's this desert, dry land mountain boy gets thrown out into Prince William Sound with ocean.
Temperate rainforest, yeah.
Yeah, so right, rainforest, ocean everywhere. And boy, that first summer was an education. Let me tell you, I learned about travel and small boats and all that. I was a couple of times, I just about lost it, may not even be here, because getting out in rough water and storms, we used skiffs, we used helicopters, we based out of various lodge on the southern end of Night Island, we based out of Port Ashton, various places in the Sound to do our work. And it basically consisted of, you know, going out and looking through the literature first, which I enjoyed a lot, and then going, you know, seeing where all the different documented mines and prospects were, and going out and finding these places and just, you know, taking samples, mapping the geology just to see, is there enough here that somebody might be able to, you know, turn it into a mine. And just to back up a little bit on the history, mining in the Sound goes back to just about the turn of the century, when prospectors out there saw some of the Chugach natives crushing up chalcopyrite, which is copper ore, to stain their Bidarka paddles. And the natives took the prospectors to a place on Latouche Island, and where the actual exposures where the copper minerals were, and that became the Beetson Mine, which operated for about 30, 40 years out there. It was the Kennecott Copper Corporation owned it, and they had another one up at Elmar. So that's how kind of the mining started on the Sound. And as you know, being around Night Island, there's lots of old copper prospects, Rua Cove and those places. So this gave me It was quite a project. That first summer, I learned how to do logistics, how to manage a field crew. You know, I basically was in charge of the operation. And a lot of times it happened to us in Alaska. You come up here, you get to move up, how would I say, career ladder, maybe faster than you would down south. And I know a lot of us that came up in the early 80s, you know, had that happen. Yep. And so, you know, I was thrown into, you know, a lot of positions of responsibility, you know, early on. And that really helped me, you know, later in my career, as far as, you know, planning logistics, running projects, crews, you know, aviation, all that sort of thing. So it was good. It was a good beginning. Luckily, I survived that first summer out there.
What other opportunities, like I think about event, you talk about these fortuitous events that came along that influenced your career. I'm thinking about moments in the field, like either near misses or aha moments in the field that did affect how you operated later on.
Oh boy, moments in the field. Boy, there's a bunch of them. I've been charged by grizzly bears twice. Luckily, fended them off both times.
Let's go back to that. Fended them off. What did you do?
Well, fended them off. Well, luckily, we had gold pans and rock hammers, and we made lots of noise. The other time, we shot over their heads with our pistols, and we were able to get them to stop. Okay. But, you know, things like, you know, when you're out in the field, those are the kind of things you have to deal with. That was more in the interior. But had that happen, you know, getting caught out in a small skiff and with a storm coming in with big waves and everything else, and hoping, oh my goodness, I hope I get through this and back to home. And there were some moments there that were, oof, I hope this is gonna work out, so to speak. One time having to rescue a person that was adrift in a boat, and getting out of a helicopter, hovering over the top of them and dropping them an extra outboard motor so that they could get to shore. That was really a scary one. I could have easily fallen in the water, but, you know, these people really needed help. They had a little baby with them. Their engine had died, and we flew out and helped them with another engine so they could get to shore. So, yeah, things like, you know, things like that. And then moments when I'd be out with the mosquitoes and the rain, and it's like, why am I doing this, you know? But, and I'll get into this later. A lot of what we did has been very useful information and, you know, used by lots of different groups there, the stuff that we did out there. And there's a whole, you know, ended up writing reports on that sort of thing. Of course, that's the final thing, is putting all your information and together and publishing reports on it, too. So
one thing, when you think about Prince William Sound, I always think about, it seems untamed to go out there and there's not a lot of sign of humans. But it's amazing when you look at the land plats and the mining records that, like, a place like Nile Island was state. Yeah. The whole thing was state. There was a lot of activity out there in the early 1900s.
Yep. That was about the time that America started to electrify itself.
Mm-hmm.
And copper was found to be one of the best conductors. So there was all this copper wire that we're going to need to light all these houses up. So there was a big push for copper exploration. So that's how a lot of those places, maybe you've been to Rua Cove, one. But the only, like I say, the only ones that really produced were the Elamar and then the Beatson mine, as far as copper production goes. And those were both, you know, Kennecott operations.
Yeah. And the Kennecott came first, right? The big mine up in Wrangell. That came first, and then they started looking around for something else.
They started looking around for other deposits, and then also developed those two. Yeah, deposits.
And you have a book, Fire and Ice, Geology of Prince William Sound, a little pamphlet that I've enjoyed over the years.
Good. Yeah. Well, that kind of came out to, as we'd be out doing this geologic work, I'd start running into these groups of sea kayakers. Wow, that looks kind of neat. And a lot of them were, you may remember Jack Bellerado. I met him paddling and all that. We were staying at a lodge there in the south end of Night Island with the infamous Marla Adkins, quite the woman that lived out there for many years.
I remember,
you remember Marla? She was a piece of work. Yeah. Anyway, bless her heart. Anyway, so I started meeting these kayakers, and they would start asking me all these questions. What's going on here? What's the geology? We don't know. You know, well, there's, you know, and there's these technical reports out there, but a lot of, you know, the common person is like, what's this all about? I don't understand this. And I finally started thinking about this and going, you know, we need to put something out that, you know, sort of people can understand, you know, the basic geology. And that's what led to that. You know, that little booklet that I did for people. And then also, you know, the people I worked with out there, Steve Nelson, Marty Miller, it was a combination. The Bureau of Mines did the work on the actual prospects and mines, and then the USGS looked at the big picture. And those were geologists that I worked with out there on those projects. And it was great putting that together, and I think, you know, well-received. It's out of print now, but I've gotten a lot of good feedback. Yeah. I'm glad that we did that that little publication. And then I think, you were out there. I didn't meet you when you were out there, but you were a Knowles instructor out in the Sound. And so because of that, I also, on my own, I got into this sea kayaking thing and did a bunch of trips out there after the project was over. I went back and paddled. My wife, Tricia, and I just paddled all over the place out there and explored the Sound, and that's also a bit what led to the, you know, doing that publication, you know, that we put out.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torda. I have Joe Kurtak with me in the studio talking about his life as an Alaskan geologist. Let's stay focused on Prince William Sound for a little bit, Joe. So in a snapshot, Why Prince William Sound? I'm talking about geology.
Yeah.
Can you do a little snapshot for folks of? I'm fascinated with it.
Yeah.
It seems like my understanding, and tell me if I'm way off base, is that we have little bits of California like accreting on to Alaska and something like that. Is that, am I even in the ballpark there?
Yeah, you've got the general idea. Basically, you're familiar with plate tectonics. You're familiar with, you know, the Earth's surface is kind of like a cracked eggshell with all these different plates that are moving around and banging into each other and all that. Well, up in Prince William Sound, the two significant plates are the North American plate, which is the continent, and then we have an oceanic plate, you know, the Pacific oceanic plate. And basically what's going on is out in the Pacific Ocean, we have these rift areas, okay, where actually molten material is coming up from down way deep in the crust or the mantle and keeps getting added to that oceanic plate. So the oceanic
plate.
That's like Hawaii, right? So the oceanic plate keeps expanding. Well, where the oceanic plate meets the North American plate, okay, it's the North American or the oceanic Pacific plate is actually slowly moving north, okay, along the North American plate. And basically sediments and material that were deposited, say, a few million years ago down, say, near the Charlotte Islands or Vancouver Island are now up in Prince William Sound, okay? Mm-hmm. Because this plate has carried those sediments as it's moved north. And basically where those piles of sediments make contact with in the Gulf of Alaska, that's what I call the armpit of Alaska, those piles of sediment get scraped off basically on the edge of the continent. And this is what we call geologic terrains. And there's been a whole series of them have been kind of attached to the North American continent as this plate moves north and these material gets scraped off. And as you go further north, then it's actually the Aleutian Trench, and that's where that plate actually subducts, and then you get all the volcanoes. So these in Prince William Sound, going from, say, Anchorage here, the oldest terrains is, say, the Chugach Terrain, and then you have the Prince William Terrain after that, which is Prince William Sound. And these, a lot of sedimentary rocks that have been basically dumped into a basin that formed as this Pacific plate moved north along the North American plate. So you get all the sediment dumped in there, and that's where a lot of the sedimentary rocks come from. But also you had volcanic rocks basically coming up out of these fissures and also intermixing with those volcanic rocks. And you may be familiar with the pillow basalts out there. Yep. The pillow basalts basically look
Night
like
Island,
big,
yep.
Yeah, Night Island. Yep. There's lots of them there. That's basically where that lava was extruded onto the seafloor and went through this rapid cooling is basically what happened there. And you get those big piles of like I say, they look like bread loaves or footballs. And those are a result of the volcanics there is what they are, and that's the pillow basalts. So then you've got all the sediment dumped into this basin. Of course, as these plates keep moving together, the mountains actually started to lift up because of all the compression that was going on. And at the same time, you also had hot spots underneath these plates here where magma would work its way to the surface, say in some sort of weak zone in the plate, and wouldn't come all the way to the surface and form a volcano like you would get out in the Aleutians, but would cool and crystallize at what we call a batholith, would come up as magma and then cool and crystallize as a batholith. And then as you had uplift, those rocks would be exposed. So places like Esther Island, the Esther Pluton, Port Nelly Juan, the granites you get in Port Nelly Juan, those are the granitic rocks. Those are those granites basically that was cooling magma that formed there. Yeah. So that's those rock types. So it's a very interesting history. And then of course you had continued, collision of the plates, uplift of the mountains. Then you had, later uplift. Then you had glaciation. And at the same time that you were interjecting these volcanic rocks, a lot of them were rich in metals like copper and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the quickie view of the geology out there.
Yeah. And then gold.
And then you also had the copper deposits, and you had the quartz veins associated with those volcanic rocks and granites, and places like the Cliff Mine, the Granite Mine. Those are the gold deposits that were mined, and those are basically gold and quartz veins. Yeah. That basically formed as a result of those intrusions of the granitics. Yeah, so it's
Very
interesting.
In the early 1900s, there was a lot of people living out there. Obviously, the indigenous people that you asked me have been out there for thousands of years, which is always amazes me. But then you had these miners come in, and you had substantial communities living out there for a little while at least.
There was, I think, up to, 400 people living out at Latusha one time. It was a major stop on the steamship route coming up from Seattle and all that. So, it was quite the community. And then you had Elamar. That was another place where there was quite a community at Elamar, too.
Right. Well, we're about to take a break. This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torda. We have Joe Kurtak talking about his life as an Alaskan geologist, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. I'm here with Joe Krutak in the studio talking about his career as an Alaskan geologist. Very fascinating, Joe. Let's talk a little bit more about Pertium Sound. And obviously, the big geological event in the Sound was the 1964 earthquake. So talk to us a bit about that.
Oh, yeah.
Big event.
Well, remember going back, I talk about, you know, the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate kind of colliding and then kind of scraping along in a big what we call a lateral strike fault as the Pacific Plate would move north. Well, every so often, tension builds up in these plates at their contacts. And every so often, that tension builds up to the place where one will give. There'll be a little bump, okay, mm-hmm. where one of the plates adjusts itself to what's going on. Well, that leads to earthquakes, and the big one, you know, this recorded time anyway, was the 1964 quake, and its epicenter was out in Unakwik, if you know where Unakwik is, and it was, I think it's the number two. I think it's been adjusted to what 9.2, I think, on the Richter scale. The only one that was bigger is one that was down in Chile. Mm-hmm. So it's number two on the list as far as I know. And as you know, major destruction, all the, you know, the coastal towns, Seward, Kodiak, all those places, big tsunamis basically mm-hmm. occurred. They think a lot of it was submarine landslides at the heads of a lot of the mm-hmm. fjords, and mm-hmm. that displaced all this water. So big waves coming into Whittier, you know, 70, 80 feet high. And lots of destruction. And what I think it shook for something like 3 minutes. It's just an incredible event. And what basically happened is this area around Prince William Sound to Anchorage, that terrain or that plate basically tilted, okay? Mm-hmm. Out on the Sound, it rose up. Around Anchorage, it dropped. And that's why when you go down to, say, Portage, you see all those dead trees there mm-hmm, as you go mm-hmm. around the end of the highway. Those were the land dropped about 6 feet, and those trees were flooded with seawater and killed them. You go out to Montague Island, places like that, 25 feet uplift out on that mm-hmm. end. So you had this tilting action that went on. And I've read a few accounts of what it was like out on the Sound. Well, you probably know the village Chiniga. Mm-hmm. The village of Chiniga was basically destroyed by a seismic sea wave that occurred as a result of that quake.
Yeah.
So it was quite the event.
Yeah,
quite
there's the some event. Good books about that, very tragically, I think.
Yeah.
I think 30 people lost their lives just in Chiniga. I think it was a 90-foot wave or something.
It was
quite something.
It was big.
Very
that
tragic.
Took out the village. Yeah, so that was, you know, that was the 64 quake. What caused it and what happened,
and,
you know.
And for those of us that were in Anchorage at the recent earthquake, that was seemed big, but it was like a 7-something, I think.
Right, I think it was a 7.2 or something like that. I know this is, you know, and as you know, it's a logarithmic scale,
right,
so it really expands. And, you know, I've talked to people who lived through it, and it shook for like 3 minutes in Anchorage.
Right.
You know, with the 1 and 2, that was at, I don't know, a minute or something like that. So, yeah, it's like, whoa.
Well, so you're a kayaker, great. Too.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What's your advice for people if you're out there kayaking or sitting on the shore having a picnic?
I guess it can happen any time. How much do you worry about it? You know, I'm more worried about one of the big tankers going by or one of the cruise ships or whatever and making sure I'm high enough on the beach for the wake that comes by from, you know, one of those ships and stuff like that. But, you know, it can happen any time. You just, you know, you just... It's part of living up here.
Yeah.
You know, it's just part of living up here.
We've been this Berry Arm landslide potential up in Berry Arm, up in College Fjords, has woken everybody up to the potential and my responses. And you're worried about this now? It's every time I go out there, I think about, okay, if the ground starts shaking, where am I going to run to? What's my exit strategy? And how far up can I get as fast as I can get?
That's right.
Or if I'm in a boat, how deep of water?
Right.
Where's the nearest bit of deep of water and how fast can I get there if I'm in my boat?
Right. Part of life. Part of life out there.
You have this the book about the geology of Pertium Sound, Rock and Ice. But let's talk about Jim and Nancy Lethko. They also had a book and had a publishing company. Published my book about kayaking and camping in Pertium Sound. How did they influence you, and how did you get to know them?
Well, I basically met them on some of my kayaking trips out there, and we had published, they had copies of the reports that I had published on my work out there, and they became very interested in the geology and the glaciers out there. In fact, I think they actually lived out there starting sometime in the 1960s, so they knew the sound very well. They had their sailing safari company where they would take people out and teach them how to sail. And I just met them several times, and they would always, if we were kayaking, and they would invite us over to dinner, their boat, or, you know, that sort of thing. But I always had to, for dinner, I would always have to identify a bunch of rocks for Nancy. Nancy would have the rocks all laid out on the settee, and she would have the little white paint and the little fine pen. Okay, Joe, what's this? Well, that's a sandstone. Oh, that's a piece of granite. Oh, this is some basalt. So that's how would I say, paid for my dinner, so to speak. So we became quite good friends. We'd meet out there quite a bit. And then, you know, Jim just started really getting into the geology thing. It's just amazing. And that book is, you know, way beyond my knowledge of the geology out there. Yeah. Just fabulous. And then Nancy herself, she did one on the glaciers of yep. Prince William Sound. So yeah, great additions to you know what's going on out there. But no, they were great people people out in the sound there. Right.
You also published some other books. You published Mine in the Sky. That was explain what that was about.
Yeah, Mine in the Sky was basically a history of the Pine Creek Tungsten Mine.
Okay,
and
you know,
after growing up there, years and years later, I really got into technical writing and also creative writing, and I go, somebody needs to record the history of this mine. I mean, there's a lot that went on here, and the contributions that, you know, that mine made to, you know, our mineral resources in this country. So I took a year off from my job and basically went out and interviewed people. Luckily, a lot of the old timers were still alive. And like I say, this mine was up to 13,000 feet in the High Sierra. So really a challenging environment to work in. So I spent a year putting all that information together, interviewing people. It was actually a lot of fun. I really felt like I was giving back, you know, by putting that history together, and ended up publishing it as a book. And I've sold every copy. It's out of print right now, which is always nice for an author to have all their books sold. So that's when I get one of my real writing projects I enjoyed. And then also, besides the geology of the sound, we also did one on gold panning.
Right.
That the Forest Service wanted us to do, because everybody calls, where can I go do some gold panning? I've got some relatives that have just come up, and we want to go out and pan gold. Here's this book right here. Here's where you can go. There's about six sites we have on the Kenai that you can't stake mining claims on that are open to recreational mining. And that publication is still in print. You can get copies of that from the BLM or from the Forest Service. And it's a recreational gold mining on the Kenai Peninsula.
That's the title of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the title of it. So, well, yeah.
So talk about that. Let's see. I have a class coming up this summer. We're recording this in the end of June. This will air in August. But still, what advice do you give to somebody who wants to go out and gold pan?
Well, the advice we can give, we actually have places where you might be able to find a little bit of gold, which is always nice. Yeah. And
not going to tell people where that is, right? You're not supposed to keep that secret, right?
Well, this is on public land. There's no mining claims, and you know nobody's going to shoot at you and run you off or anything like that. And basically, in the booklet, we give instruction on how to pan and all that. Obviously, you got to have a gold pan and a shovel, that sort of thing.
Right.
And we just try to keep it at that recreational level, and where to look for spots in the creeks where the gold might concentrate and all that. And I think it's pretty complete. And if, you know, there's nothing like watching somebody when they first see a flake of gold in their gold pan and how their eyes light up and, oh my goodness, gold fever, here it comes, man. Oh, geez. You know, and some people, other people are like, oh man, where can I get more of this? You know? So, it's a lot of fun. But like I say, this booklet is pretty much gives you everything you need to know. There's a panning site at Bertha Creek. There's one down Six Mile Creek. We have one over at Quartz Creek where you can go and recreational pan. And I know it's very exciting because a lot of people, they come to Alaska, they want to know about the gold rush and all that. And this is one way that you can, you know, kind of experience it a little bit by finding some of your own, own gold. Yeah. So,
be clear, you can't just go anywhere and do it.
Right, right.
People have claims.
There's people have mining claims
and
probably don't want you doing that. One other place you can go to is the Crow Creek Mine up Crow Creek. That's a commercial place where you can pay to pan there. That's another place that you can also go.
Fun. This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tort. We're on Alaska Public Media. We're talking to Jill Krutak about his life as an Alaska geologist. Let's talk a bit about after Prince William Sound, where you went, and particularly in 1980, the Alaska National Interest Lands Claims Act, otherwise known as the Alaska Lands Act, passed, signed by Jimmy Carter, very controversial in Alaska, and you're in the thick of that. So how'd that influence where you went next and what happened to your career?
Okay. Yeah, you bet. That was, ANILCA had a major, major influence on the rest of my career. There was one statement in ANILCA, there's one sentence in ANILCA, and it says there that the Secretary of the Interior will evaluate all mineral resources in Alaska, including federal and state lands. And that was my mantra for the next 25 years, basically. We went out and did large-scale mineral assessments on big tracts of land all over Alaska, and basically from all the way down to the end of Baranof Island all the way up to the North Slope. So it was, they basically gave me a helicopter and a budget and said, go look at mineral deposits, Joe. I could have never been so lucky again.
Wow.
I mean, it was a phenomenal career to just learn about Alaskan geology and Alaskan mineral deposits. And I always look at going out to look at, say, where minerals might be. And I always like think of it as kind of like a smoking gun or a crime scene, you know? Mm-hmm. What went on here? What did Mother Nature do here? How come these rocks are like this? How come these metals are here? What happened here? And I love that sort of thing, kind of being Sherlock Holmes and sort of putting together a geologic picture, you know, mapping the geology, taking samples, trying to figure out what happened. As John McPhee said in one of his books, geologists inhabit landscapes that none of us have ever seen. I'm back 200 million years ago, looking at what it might have been 200 million years ago. You know, that's the scene that I'm trying to recreate, you know, with my work. And, you know, it's not all just field work. I mean, a lot of reports have to be written, and luckily I enjoy technical writing, and you need to, you know, be able to put information together that somebody else can use. And a lot of our reports have been used a lot by, you know, the different government agencies that are doing land planning, the native corporations that are doing land selections. You know, they would like to maybe make a land selection where there might end up being another Red Dog or another big zinc mine that, you know, they can get royalties from. Mineral exploration companies that are looking for new deposits, you know, they can use that information. So there's a whole variety of users for the reports. And like I say, I've got a whole bookshelf full of, you know, the reports that I've published. And I still get contacts from people, you know, wanting to know about certain areas, which is nice. It makes me feel good, like, okay, you accomplished something here that, you know, people are using the information. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people think, okay, mining, you know, it's kind of this big dirty smokestack thing. But you got to remember, you know, you get up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you're using minerals. You get in your car, you're using minerals. You come to your computer, there's gold in your computer. You write on paper, there's limestone in there. I mean, there's all these different mineral resources out there that we use every day, you know. And, you know, it's important to have, you know, sources.
Yeah. I was going to ask you that. How do you reconcile? You're obviously a lover of wilderness. You like going out kayaking and mountaineering and climbing. Yeah. But how do you reconcile that and the idea that, well, maybe some of your work would create something that might, you know, affect that that aesthetic.
Right. Well, luckily, you know, these, you know, we have planning agencies that can deal with that. We have governmental agencies that can deal with it. The big thing is, you know, doing it in an environmentally responsible way. And can these, you know, can these deposits be developed? You know, basically, are they economic? You know, and that's what needs to be, that's what needs to be looked at. But, you know, mining has gotten a bad name in the past for some of the messes that have happened. And, you know, places like the Beatson, right now the Beatson mine is being cleaned up. That's going on right
that's
now.
That's an interesting project.
That's an interesting project.
Prince William South, Southern Prince William Sound. And that's a mining company that had nothing really to do with it. I think Rio Tinto is cleaning it up, and they just happened to inherit it.
They bought out Kennecott, and basically that came along with it. So, you know, they're living up to it. And
that's impressive, actually.
It's impressive that they're cleaning the place up. So I think mining has really tried to, you know, give itself a much better, you know, a much better face in that way. But, you know, like I say, you know, all these things need to be evaluated, and you know, what's it going to do to the environment? So that's, you know, one of my things. Yeah, I have to think about it too.
But on the other hand, it's fascinating to me of how, like, back to Prince William Sound and seeing a pillar of basalt, like in your mind, that tells a story. It's a fascinating story that goes back hundreds and hundreds of millions of years. And I think that, like, I just did a trip on the 40 Mile River, which you're a little familiar with, and being able to see fossils along the Yukon that are like from the ocean. It's really interesting to me.
I know. Right? Yeah. Wow, there was a sea here at one time.
Right. How'd that happen? Right. Well, yeah.
And you probably saw a few gold miners.
Yeah. And so let's talk about that next phase of your work. And so you're traveling around and you're seeing, but you're also working with miners, right?
Oh, yeah, working with miners. Yeah, we go out to a lot of the mine sites and see what they're doing, talk to them about their mining and all that. A lot of them love to tell you about what they're doing, you know. And so, yeah, got to work with quite a few miners, you know, as far as, you know, what their operations are like. And, you know, are they getting gold? Are they not getting gold? You can always tell, oh, man, we're not getting anything. And others are, when they don't talk about it at all, that's the ones you got to remember. They don't say anything.
Well, I'll tell a quick story. I was driving back from Wiseman, and I picked up a hitchhiker. And he was like that. He was very, very quiet. He wasn't saying much. But it's a long drive from Wiseman to Fairbanks. And over time, when I learned he was a snorkel miner, which I want you to explain, because we see those around, you see them. Yeah. And boy, when I mentioned your name, the door opened. Joe. And and he told me how much, and he ended up showing me his poke. He's showing us a little vial of gold. Okay. It was weighed quite a bit, it seemed like to me. And that was his year's earnings. And he was going to go off to sell it in Fairbanks, cash it out, and then go down to Mexico and spend the winter. And he'd been doing it for like 10 years, been doing this.
I probably met him because we did a big mineral assessment on both the north side and the south side of the Brooks Range. And that whole Wiseman area we evaluated. So that's probably where I got I got to know some of those guys. Yeah. And I do mention it's not, you know, it's not all field work. You got to put all this data together, you know, something that people can read. So I call it the funnel. So you get all this data on the top of the funnel, and you kind of compress it all down, and get this trickle out the bottom, and that's what you got to write about, so you can put information together that's usable, and that's as much as the field work, you know, sort of thing. And I'll mention that when I talk about mentoring and that sort of thing too. So so got around a lot. I was very, very fortunate. Like I said, I could never be so lucky again with my career, just to see so much, you know, so much country. And the geology. Well,
and let's talk about some of the mentors, since you brought that up. Who are some people that influenced you and people that you've influenced too?
Yeah, well,
and talk about that. What made a good mentor? What do you think makes, you know, a good mentor or being a good mentor to other people?
Well, you know, big thing is, I guess, you know, taking time to give back. So my early mentors, I mentioned the mining engineer at Pine Creek that had worked in Alaska. I was very fortunate. They had university professors that believed in me. I'm incredibly dyslexic. I'm very dyslexic, and I've had to deal with dyslexia my whole life. In fact, it was never diagnosed when I was a kid, and so I look at books backwards and everything else. So it was always difficult for me in college because of that. But I had some good mentors that believed in me. And then also in my work environment, my one boss here for the Bureau of Mines, Don Blasco, he was great. He would kind of line me out on what needed to be done and said, okay, Joe, I'm not going to fool around with you. You go do your thing, you know. And the only time that we had a problem was when I was out working with a field crew and the helicopter pilot decided to land the helicopter on the railroad tracks north of Talkeetna to pick up a field crew.
Doesn't sound good.
No, and guess who was driving down in his wheel-flanged pickup truck at the same time and had to stop for the helicopter? The section boss. Boy, did he make a call and did I get a call? It was like the phone was out here. What the heck are you doing up there, Joe? Woof, I had to do some fast talking on that one. So those are the kind of stories, things that happen that you have to deal with. Yeah, the railroad was not happy in that situation. So just, you know, a lot of those different kind of, you know, stories that, you know, happen in you know, dealing with the different people and, you know, out in the country. Other mentors. When I first came up here, my first summer up here in 71, I met Chuck Hawley and Don Richter. Don Richter was obviously heavily involved with the ski club
The Richter Loop.
Named for Don Richter. Well, these guys were like godlike figures to me. These were Alaskan geologists. Holy mackerel. I mean, they were out there on the leading edge, and I always thought every time I'd come to an outcrop, And some rocks, I wonder if I'm the first geologist to actually bang on these rocks. In Alaska, that might be the case. That might be the case. There's a lot of country out there. So, you know, those type of geologists were influential. Various bosses that I had along the way, great influence. And I was very lucky to have really good bosses, in which really helped a lot to, you know, further my career. And how would I say? They let me, they didn't micromanage me. Joe, go out there and do your thing. And, you know, Prince William Sound was one of the classics. That was really thrown into the breach there. But like I say, I used what I learned there, you know, for the rest of my career, because I was, you know, running field crews, hiring people, getting helicopter contracts, setting up camps. It's complicated. It's a lot of work putting all that together, and it basically kind of fell, you know, on my shoulders. Yeah, which was good.
So. Let's, you know, also talk about the other outdoor interests. What you I think that sounds like the outdoor stuff. You ran into sea kayakers, so you became a sea kayaker.
I became a sea kayaker.
And I think that's where we first met. We're maybe working for Doug Fessler and Jill Fredston in the Alaska Mountain Safety Center teaching kayaking. Right. And so talk a little bit about that part of your life.
Yeah. Like I say, you know, I meeting these kayakers, I really got into sea kayaking. So did a lot of that sort of thing, been all over the sound on my personal trips. And then the skiing thing, you know, mountaineering and then skiing. You know, I ended up joining the National Ski Patrol. In fact, my wife Trisha and I have just celebrated our 40th year with the National Ski Patrol.
Congratulations! Yeah.
And anyway, so that was that's pretty neat. And then referring back to the program you had a couple weeks ago with the search and rescue people, I'm also part of that organization, the Alaska Search and Rescue Association, and also in the Nordic Ski Patrol. And I even patrol up at Arctic Valley some. You may see me there with my red jacket and my white cross on. And also I got very interested in avalanche education because I'm lucky that I survived a couple of near misses with avalanches in my early career up here. And then two good geologist friends of mine, Jeff Radford and Bruce Hickok, they were geologists, and they were killed in an avalanche up on Peak 3 in 1994.
Yeah,
it was very sad. And we ended up setting up an endowment for them through the Society of Economic Geologists, and we give out a research grant every year to a geologist that, you know, say in school, in graduate school, that wants to do field work. So we've kind of kept their legacy going there. And also I teach, I'm an instructor for avalanche rescue and that sort of thing too. I still keep that up.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, but that's where I can kind of give back, you know, along the skiing avalanche thing. So,
and along the way, you're working primarily for the federal government.
Yeah,
whole career. I think of the federal government as this very large bureaucracy that is sort of safety conscious. Like, how do you get away with a lot, like going out in the field like this? And so we talk about landing the helicopter on the railroad tracks, you know, and I'm sure that wasn't an SOP, right?
No, it was not. No, I was, when I first, you know, I'd never worked for the feds before, and it started in 80. They give you this big handful of, you know, forms you're supposed to fill out and all that, and they gave me everything but a typewriter to fill the forms out with. They had to be filled out in triplicate. So you kind of learn to work with that system. And sometimes it's can be better to go ask for forgiveness. Ask for forgiveness. That's half. Let's just go do this, and we'll have our hat in our hand, and we'll ask for forgiveness later. That happened a time or two. But, you know, there's certain things you got to go by the rules, and you learn to live with it. But like I say, I had bosses that were very good that way. Okay, this is okay. This is what we need to do. Okay, we'll do it this way, and we'll get the job done, and all that. So I was very, very lucky in that way. And you just kind of learn to live with the bureaucracy, and, you know, use it how you can to get the job done.
Right.
So,
when you're I'll tell a story with the Nordic Ski Patrol a couple of years ago. I was doing the Sven Johansson, I think. I don't know if you remember this.
And I remember you. Yes.
I cratered at the bottom of a hill and blooded my nose up pretty bad. And I remember the director, Zach Littler, was there, and he bandaged me up. And I didn't realize. He said, "We're not going to finish, are you?" I'm like, "Oh, of course I'm going to finish the race." And so then I'm limping along. And first I run into Trish, your wife, at one of the stations. They're a little aghast to see me. And then I remember skidding up a hill. top of Kincaid, I think, or top of the liquor sloop, and you're standing there, and you're like, Paul, how you doing? I'm like, what do you think?
Whoa, Paul, what happened to you? What happened to you? Well, that's good that's one of the things we do. We patrol all the, the Nordic Ski Club races and watching for that sort of thing. So
how common is that in those races? I mean, those guys are always out there, which is just fantastic. Yeah. And I'm like, well, okay, it's a ski race. They're a bunch of fit people, but
I'm
glad you were there for me.
It happens. We have people fall. A lot of people fall. I think we've actually maybe even had a heart attack or two. Over the years, and people falling, scrapes, that sort of thing. Yeah. It happen. So it's good that we're there. Patrolling those races. We do their races. We do their backcountry tours. Provide ski patrollers for a lot of those events. And then we also do backcountry patrols on our own, where we just go out and cruise around in the backcountry and see what's going on. And we also do a lot of snow observations for the Chugach Avalanche Center. Yeah. We're part of the group that sends in snow observations, so they use that information to do their forecasts.
That's super valuable.
In the wintertime. Very valuable. Yeah. In fact, I guess there's talk of maybe actually having a forecast for the Chugach Front Range.
Yeah, I've heard that rumor.
We'll see how that, and a couple
in Seward also.
We're
about out of time here, Joe. Yeah. It's been wonderful. Let's talk a little bit of advice you have for younger folks starting in field science or in the outdoors.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
You bet. I've definitely got a few thoughts there. I guess the big thing with me is finding your passion in life and following it, and that will get you through the ups and downs of life. Find a passion, pursue it. And for me, it was geology and earth sciences. And I guess my advice would be for people that are interested in it is, find a good school in geology so you get a good field-oriented education. A lot of places nowadays are getting away from the field stuff, and everybody's sitting in front of a computer and doing graphs and all that kind of stuff, and that's pretty. But discovery is in the field. Mm-hmm. That's where it is. That's where you're going to make the big difference. So go to a good school. Nowadays, a lot of the companies, different federal organizations, get all the, ArcCAD, GIS, all those kind of classes that you can get. Because nowadays, I'm out there with my piece of Mylar and a lead pencil, and the young guys are out there with their tablet putting all the data in. So you want to learn all as much of that stuff as you can. But one thing I find about the young people a lot is they can do all the ArcCAD, they can do all the mapping, I'll make all these pretty maps. Okay, write me a paragraph. Write me a paragraph, summarize what you did. Oh, boy. Well, okay. So I really recommend take a technical writing course. A lot of universities don't have that as their standard curriculum. Public speaking. Mm-hmm. Going out so you can get more funding to go out there and have fun out in the field. Take a public speaking class. And there's some of the things that you want to do along the way. And also in Alaska, we're very fortunate here is there's a lot of summer work in geology.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of temporary jobs, and especially right now because we're coming out of COVID and a lot of companies that weren't doing much during COVID are out there beating the brush.
Yeah.
And if you're a geology student, say over at UAA, there's no reason why you shouldn't have a summer job. And to me, you want to go out and check it out. You're taking these classes.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Am I going to enjoy being out there in the rain with all those mosquitoes going through the Devil's Club? Well, I might want to check.
That's in the fine print, yeah.
That's right. That's in the fine
print.
You got it.
In the brochure, yeah.
You got it. That's in the fine print. And also, join geology organizations. Get involved. Get involved with geology organizations. Things like, Geological Society of America or the Society of Economic Geologists. And there is, I'm on the Citizens Advisory Board for the geology department over at UAA.
Yeah.
And we try to help them out. We have a geology club there, and I try to help them, with summer jobs and that. And we actually do a couple field trips a year where I take them out and do things like take them up to Crow Pass and show them gold mines.
Oh, fun.
Or take them to Hope and show them what a placer mining operation is like. So I try to really stay involved with the students and stuff like that. So
well, good for you.
So, yeah, that's. I think it's real important these part in our careers that we need to give back,
This has been Outdoor Explorer. Joe, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to my guest, Joe Krutek. Links to his books on the Outdoor Explorer website. And a big thanks to our producer, Eric Bork. This is your host, Paul Tordock, and tomorrow, the host at Outdoor Explorer. Thanks for listening. Pick up a rock, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.